Welcome to the People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and on today's show, we'll be speaking with John Turnbull, the man behind the great website, theglobalgame.com. But first, stray thoughts on the tournament so far. In my humble opinion, today's match between Brazil and North Korea was the highlight of the tournament to date. The tournament favorites, Brazil, had to squirm as the great unknown quantity of the tournament, North Korea, proved they really knew how to play on a soccer field. And for 50-plus minutes, the stock of state Stalinism soared, to mix metaphors, as the North Koreans' athleticism and finesse successfully blocked off the Brazilian attack and flash on the counterattack, the North Koreans looked dynamic and dangerous. Of course, sooner or later, the Brazilians did break through with a gorgeous goal by Maicon. Another goal followed, but with 88 minutes played, the North Koreans broke through. And then in the final 5 minutes of the match, the Koreans had two more chances to even up. It was a thrill, totally unexpected, just like the World Cup. 1966, in the house. Earlier in the day, of course, Ivory Coast squared off against Portugal, and the two sides were like heavyweight boxers feeling each other out in the early rounds of the bout, and somehow the later rounds of the bout never occurred. We had the messiah of the tournament, Didier Drogba, return, and that, to me, was the highlight moment of the match. Cristiano Ronaldo hit a lightning strike 10 minutes in that went off the post, but never showed anything like that again throughout the rest of the match. It will be interesting to see what North Korea does when they face those two teams. I do believe they will have to play stronger to beat the now not-so-unknown quantity. New Zealand provided a great thrill right at the end of the match as they pulled out a draw against favored Slovakia. That means that Paraguay, Slovakia, New Zealand, and Italy are all even at 1 point apiece, and the defending world champions have to be feeling a little better about themselves after their flat performance yesterday. Tomorrow morning early, Honduras takes on Chile. Then co-tournament favorite Spain matches up against Switzerland, and then we roll all the way back around to Group A as the host nation South Africa takes on Uruguay. And tomorrow we'll be returning to our regular structured programming here on The People's Game, but today an extended conversation with John Turnbull from The Global Game. Welcome to The People's Game, Pacifica Radio's show on the 2010 World Cup Soccer Tournament. I'm your co-host, Alan Minsky, and right now we're going to be speaking with John Turnbull. John Turnbull is the editor of an amazing website called The Global Game, Soccer as a Second Language. And you can find that at www.theglobalgame.com. And John Turnbull is also the co-editor of an amazing collection, The Global Game, Writers on Soccer, just fantastic literature, global literature, about the world's most popular sport. And I'm joined in studio by my co-host, Jennifer Doyle. Jennifer is a professor at University of California, Riverside, and she is herself a soccer blogger. The amazing blog is From a Left Wing. Jennifer Doyle.
Thanks, Alan, and thanks, John, for participating in this conversation with us. I, as you know, am a fan of your website and of the anthology. And I'll say about the website to listeners, it's an unusually well-researched and reliable source of information about international soccer. And you'll find there in-depth reporting on what are big stories to people like me. For example, the article you have on your website about Marta is, I think, one of the best pieces of writing on her. And you were sort of there before everyone else, Marta being the FIFA Women's Footballer of the Year, I believe, four times over, which I will say is just about because they don't know enough about women's football to recognize there are other players in the world besides Marta. But you've also been consistently taking an interest in grassroots communities, women's soccer, soccer in places like South Africa, and I believe you had a trip to South Africa within the past year. And I actually wanted to just begin with a fairly open question, knowing that you're an interesting writer and thinker about this sport, and just to ask you how you, as a writer and as an independent journalist, are approaching the upcoming World Cup and its location in South Africa.
Well, thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. I was in South Africa last year about this time. It was the Confederations Cup. And it's a great blessing to be in a place when a World Cup is not taking place, because you get to see soccer outside the FIFA universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it soccer in the FIFA free zone. Because in a FIFA stadium, you have certain areas of interaction with players and with people. They're called mixed zones, or you have the media zone of player availabilities. You know, when you go to cover a tournament like that, it's a different kind of job. It's different than writing about it from some distance or writing about a tournament well before it takes place. And being there before it takes place, I was able to go out to a number of townships outside Cape Town and Johannesburg. And these are places where the game has thrived, where it was kept in, kept communities vibrant and mm-hmm. kept social connections available
mm-hmm.
when a government had worked so hard to keep people apart.
Yeah.
It enabled them to maintain a culture, to maintain communication with each other. And it was extraordinarily rich and much more diverse interaction of people occurring at football matches than a basic history of apartheid would suggest. There was a lot of creativity, a lot of dynamism among supporters at matches through the apartheid era, and amazing football was played just based on what I read and based on accounts of the time. And of course, it's hard to know that. There aren't recordings or TV histories of matches, but from all accounts, and maybe people tend to exaggerate, but South Africa would have had one of the best national teams in the world, according to people there, if they'd been allowed to play.
You mean during the years in which South Africa was forbidden from participating in FIFA-sanctioned international matches as a result of the Organization of African Countries, which pressured FIFA into instituting a ban against the country during the apartheid years?
Right, that's right. They were one of the original members of the Confederation of African Football, but banned in 61, and players did what they could. They formed their own integrated league, which wasn't recognized by FIFA.
Mm.
Township soccer and township football is amazing and still is amazing there. I didn't see a single grass pitch. The only grass that I saw was on the FIFA pitches.
Yeah.
They make do. Any space is appropriate and available for a game of football. I was in Soweto on a school holiday. It was the winter time, of course, a winter school holiday, and kids were out across the street from the Hector Peterson Memorial in Orlando West, that famous landmark, having a match at their school.
Mm.
And this was going on the street and in, you know, any improvised space they could get.
I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about a story that we've both addressed on our blogs and which you addressed in some depth as a result of this trip that you had last year, which is now I believe is a little more than 2 years ago, a former national team player for the women's squad in South Africa was sexually assaulted violently and murdered. Her name is Yudi Simelane, and there's been some reporting around a wave of violence against black butch lesbians in particular. And one of the things that I noticed in stories about this that I found very disturbing was a number of the women who were survivors of these kinds of homophobic assaults had been targeted coming back from football games because they were in their kit and the game is so coded as masculine. This is one of the ways in which women are being identified as lesbian and then targeted for these horrific attacks. Could you talk a little bit about your contact with this story in your trip to South Africa last year?
Sure. Yudi Simelane, as you say, was a midfielder. She played for Banyana Banyana, which is the women's national team in South Africa. She'd very much built her world around football from a very young age. She started playing in the streets when she was 4 or 5 or 6. I met many of her family members there in Kwatema, which is the township she was from. It's about 25 miles outside Johannesburg.
Mm-hmm.
She grew up playing with boys and girls in the street, and as I say, it was her life. She wasn't just a player. She was an administrator, a referee,
yeah,
a coach, and organized teams. She got older to coach both boys and girls in that township in Kwatema, which shows one thing about how people do a lot of things for themselves,
right,
there, even with independence and even after apartheid, at least the legal version is gone. You still have to do things on your own, and that's very true in soccer in the townships. It's interesting how many retired male players are active in townships in South Africa organizing female teams.
Oh.
And it was Yudi Simelane and some of her friends, in fact, who were picked out by a former player for Kaiser Chiefs, which is probably the most popular side in the country. They identified her, and this gave her an extraordinary life, an extraordinary prominence relative to the life that most people live in the townships there. She traveled abroad.
Yeah.
The thing that really struck me was meeting her parents, was her father was wearing an Arsenal scarf, and I'm an Arsenal fan, so I commented on it, and he said that she had brought it for him when she had gone to play some friendly matches in London, which is quite a statement because it's quite easy to get English Premier League clothing and knockoffs in South Africa, but she wanted to bring him the real article.
Right.
I found that quite moving. And she was gang raped and murdered in about 400 or 500 yards of their house.
Mm.
The site was quite nearby, and a friend of hers went through a similar ordeal a year after she died.
Yeah.
So this is a phenomenon that they call corrective rape, that awful term. And yeah, it's a documented phenomenon around the country.
It's
and I think that the prominence of these players does contribute to it.
It's an interesting, it's been interesting, again, is not the right word. It's left me, the whole story has left me speechless, I'd say. When I first read about her murder, I found that it hit home in a way that few stories, right, in the media environment, which is so saturated with stories of just horrific violence that can leave you somewhat numb. And something about her story really cut through to me, and I think it's partly about, just as a female player and having my own sort of version of coming into awareness of my body and a sense of empowerment through playing. And the very idea that her participation in the sport would be this thing which is actually opening her up to being a victim of this wave of attacks, is something about it is just completely horrifying. And then there's been the sports media has been very slow to adopt this actually as a sports story. ESPN very recently did a program about these assaults and actually identified in the program that it was soccer players who were being singled out. And that was a big step because I have actually not seen that in European and Western media making that, connecting those dots, that it's women's participation in soccer that's identifying them as queer. And then they actually didn't extend the story further, you know, which is that obviously ESPN is in South Africa right now because the World Cup is coming up. I can't imagine why they would be sort of interested in this story if it weren't for the World Cup. But they didn't actually make any connection within that story. And perhaps because the journalists who wrote that story had to sign an agreement with FIFA, pledging that they wouldn't actually bring FIFA into disrepute, because I'm learning that journalists are asked to do that. You know, but FIFA has these are FIFA registered players. I mean, you know, this is a woman who is an international player representing her country in FIFA sanctioned competitions. FIFA makes a big deal out of its investment in women's soccer, but they're not using the World Cup's location in South Africa at all to stage any kind of intervention into these acts of violence.
Yeah, I mean, if I can just interject, imagine this happening to an international male player.
If if a member of a men's national team were murdered in a hate crime in the home country of the World Cup, I mean, obviously this would be the only thing the sports media would be talking about. And because it's a female player, and also because this is a homophobic attack, you know, it demands a simultaneous like recognition of the ways in which, you know, race, sex, and gender, right, are kind of coming together, right, around the story of this community of women in South Africa. And I just I feel like it's the utopian part of me that would even imagine that FIFA would care, right? But I think part of me would like to imagine that, for example, the male counterparts of these women athletes would care, right? That some of the superstars of soccer would actually step up and say that, you know, they want to actually lend their name and their face to some kind of campaign to raising awareness about the prevalence of, you know, violent attacks against women in general, but also particularly black lesbians in South Africa. But that has not happened.
There's a real clash of narratives there. I mean, needs to be, from FIFA's point of view, one narrative during the tournament, and that's why I say it's often an advantage to be there when you can get outside the FIFA bubble. This is true similarly in Cape Town, where I visited and had the chance to go to the Robben Island Museum. Of course, it's known that Robben Island prisoners played football in extraordinary circumstances during apartheid. They organized a league. They created this infrastructure using FIFA rules and using FIFA organizing principles during the term of their imprisonment to organize a league. Now, we met one of the unique aspects about the Robben Island Museum is that former inmates lead the tours. And this gentleman who took us around had been in prison there in the 1980s and had played in the league. Sort of at the end, I was curious as to what he'd be doing during the World Cup tournament, and he was not even begrudging the fact that he couldn't afford to go. I mean, the travel times and the cost of the ticket for somebody like that who had kept... I mean, if anybody is true to the principles of the sport as fair play, and the sport as something that could keep the human spirit alive in adversity, it's someone like that, and the players and the people that he was in prison with, and there didn't seem to be any special recognition or dispensation for someone like that, so that he could go to a match.
Right. So what you're saying is there are members of the footballing community within South Africa who are actually part of the mythology of football in South Africa. The Robben Island, the story of Mandela playing football, you know, while a political prisoner, is actually often reproduced within stories about South Africa's relationship to soccer. And so, if I understand you right, one of the things that you're pointing out is that there's a disconnect actually between the actual people at the heart of those stories and this major event, right, of the World Cup and the matches themselves.
Yeah, I think you know, that's been the trend over time. I think that's always the way. It's you know, I focus in the writing that I do. I really like the micro side of the game. I like how people use soccer in their daily lives as a kind of way of resisting whatever they're resisting, you know, the dominant narratives of capitalism or sexuality, whatever it is. As soccer gives you a place of transcendence, it gives you a different universe, it gives you a different place to be for that space of time. And it's you know, for me, it's time set apart from the everyday. So in that sense, it's kind of holy, and I always get you know, disturbed when it just becomes a marketing tool.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, the decision to sort of taken interest in soccer in South Africa, but not during the World Cup. I actually made a conscious decision myself to not go, partly because I thought, you know, the experience of this sport that I like and that I'm interested in and interested in documented would be almost impossible to access, I would think, if your interface, right, is this thing which is being controlled by this giant octopus, right, that is FIFA.
Yeah. One thing World Cups do, and I noticed this doing putting together a literary anthology about the game and looking at literature from around the world, is what an occasion the World Cup provides, and it has since the beginning, since 1930. It provides this occasion for people to create, for people to write, mm-hmm. for artists to do things.
Yeah.
And it leaves kind of this residue that you might not get otherwise. So I suppose that's one benefit. You get these testimonies and
the kind of conversation we're having right now, even.
I mean, this is one case, but in talking to people that I know who are in South Africa right now, and there was a piece in the Art newspaper today about there was $15 or $20 million budgeted for cultural activities and art exhibits and so on related to the World Cup. That money was never spent. Nobody seems to know where it is. And there's a real sense that opportunity has been lost. The only sort of substantive cultural work or lecturing that's been done has been initiated by the Goethe Institute of Johannesburg. And there's also quite an interesting exhibit at the District 6 Museum in Cape Town, which looks at soccer during apartheid and is a very community-based oral history trove. But those are all independent initiatives, and, you know, it's just, FIFA wants it football only.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's The People's Game. I am co-host Alan Minsky, and we're speaking with John Turnbull, whose website, a fantastic website that he edits, is called The Global Game, Soccer as a Second Language. And I'm joined in studio by my co-host Jennifer Doyle.
If I may shift gears just a little bit, I wanted to ask you about the research project that you're about to embark on, taking you to the Ukraine.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about what the subject of your, what's taking you to the Ukraine? And
sure. This is interesting because Poland and Ukraine were named as co-hosts of the 2012 European Championships, which was somewhat surprising when it came up. Co-hosting is an odd arrangement. It's odd between these two countries, Ukraine not part of the European Union, and Poland much more integrated, both very big countries, both ones obviously with a history of totalitarian control and relatively recent freedoms and independence. Again, it's looking for alternative histories in a place, and kind of the deposit of memory that football's left in Ukraine, and in particular the research I've been doing is on Jewish sides, Jewish mm-hmm. teams in the 1930s, many of whom died in the Holocaust. Dynamo Kiev is a very famous story, but there are many, many other small teams that existed in western Ukraine especially, and that left extraordinary archival records and pictures and accounts of matches and stories of how they united people in those days. That's one sort of strand that I was interested in. I'm also interested in women's football there. The Central European and Eastern European countries, much of the world, it's a difficult game for women to participate in, but even extraordinarily so in the former Soviet Union, where women really work against the grain, work against resources, and get almost no attention. I would think that even African countries do better for their women players.
It's interesting.
Countries like Ukraine.
I've heard varying sort of different little bits of information about the women's sport in different parts of the world, and I got this really interesting tidbit of information from this guy Vlad Godzich, who's a comparative literature. He's a literature professor at UC Santa Cruz, and we just happened to strike up sports talk conversation at a reception. And he told me that in the Eastern European and countries and in the Soviet Union, women were trained to be referees. And this is why you see women referees working in Eastern Europe, where you see them working nowhere else in the world, or very few places in the world. And it's like this kind of residue, actually, of those years. And it's like I noticed, actually, in some reports, just sort of articles in football magazines in Europe, there'd be like a story about a female referee, a Czech woman, working in UEFA matches. And I had, until I met this guy, I had no idea of what the story that might be behind that. And there's no way to access that kind of information without actually going out and actually talking to people and doing the real hard legwork of actually going through the kinds of archives I know that you're working with are not necessarily profoundly well-organized archives, but personal materials. And it takes a lot of work to actually figure these stories out and to put a voice right to the people whose lives you're actually trying to recover.
Well, that's true even in developed places like England, where the women's game has such a great history, and scholars have gone around with scanners to yeah. people's homes just to get the pictures that they keep, and among their personal possessions. That's a very highly developed society, and it's even more so. And there's that segregation, gender segregation by sport, as many parts of the world. It's true in South Africa also, where women's football would not have been encouraged, but women who played netball, volleyball, basketball, mm-hmm. so on. And I spent a day in South Africa when I was there with a lesbian team, and they felt, in addition to proclaiming themselves as a lesbian side, that the mere act of playing soccer as a group was a bold act of solidarity.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to the point that you had made earlier about soccer often being, especially for people who are in kind of precarious social positions, it can provide a stable space in which you can form a sense of community and a platform for the articulation of a kind of politicized sense of identity and a launching pad for intervening right in the and making the world around you sort of a better place. I know here I'm sounding very romantic, but the Chosen Few, which is the name of the club that you mentioned, I think,
right.
They bring out that romantic side in me.
Well, it's nice. You get this space of time, like I was saying before, the 90 minutes where if you're participating in the game, ideally nobody's exploiting anybody else. Nobody's trying to sell me anything.
Yeah.
I could just, I don't have to think about my position in society. I don't think about who I'm pleasing or not pleasing. That's just, liberated time.
Mm.
And you don't even have to be in a prison to have a sense of that.
You know, I played, competitively in very structured from in American youth time frame from about fifth grade on, and starting my year in living in Italy when I was an eighth grader, I played extremely structured, but also every free moment I could possibly get with any youth or person who might have a ball, and that was just pure joy.
Mm.
And people, millions, billions literally of people around the world have that shared experience with soccer. And I think your website does a marvelous job of bringing that framing to the fore just continuously.
Well, thanks. It's funny, when I grew up playing youth soccer too in the same structured environment in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., where it became popular relatively early. This was in the 70s. And I never had that experience. I enjoyed playing, but I never had that feeling of freedom.
Yeah.
The only time that ever happened was one match we were playing. I remember I was about 12 years old, and out of nowhere the Goodyear blimp appeared. There must have been some golf tournament or something going on in the area, and this is something that no one ever, you don't expect this to happen, just a blimp to be there,
yeah.
About 100, really low in the sky,
uh-huh.
just above the field, and it... and the coaches were yelling, I remember our coach in particular was yelling at us, the next person who looks at the blimp is coming out of the game. And it's pretty impossible to ignore a blimp hovering right there. And that's the only time I remember of just thinking that, you know, this is completely random, completely out of my control, and it's completely out of control of the coaches and people who tell us what to do all the time.
Right.
It was that one little glimpse of freedom that we had.
I wonder if that's that experience of a youth playing a very kind of organized and somewhat regimented soccer, which is actually a complaint that's often made about kind of mainstream youth soccer in this country, is that kids don't have enough time of just sort of unstructured forms of play. If that isn't one of the things that's behind the kind of care and thoughtfulness of your own writing about soccer and this attention that you give to recovering and putting into writing something like what the contact with what you described just now as liberated time means for people, right? And when we use the World Cup as the thing that guides our attention, unfortunately, it takes our attention not only away from the pressing social issues and political crises of the moment, but it even takes our attention away from this other aspect of the game. It gets eclipsed in essence by this sort of giant glossy media spectacle, and it's just something else which is it's actually behind our love for the game. But nevertheless, it seems to be sometimes the thing which, especially sports journalism, it can't really accommodate, because it's not about necessarily winning. It's not necessarily that competitive. It's something that's much more nuanced and fluid, I think.
Well, I'm going to be a little bit of a devil's advocate here, just for the sake of it. I generally agree with the framing, but I also think that within the World Cup tournaments, I mean, look at a team like Brazil, and you know, there's this national discourse, not necessarily about how they're doing, winning or losing, but how beautiful they're playing or not, you know. And I think people really do look for these expressions of joy on the soccer field. And as an Italian partisan traditionally, you know, I understand the rest of the world just has, not a lot of love for the Italian team in the way that it can win sometimes, because it can take the beauty out of the game.
I was born in Italy. I can't stand watching them. but the point is, the interesting thing, and it's a theme throughout soccer history, and it's in the States and true anywhere, is this idea of nervousness about unregulated space. And as soon as a space becomes a free space, it makes people nervous. And you know, see this all over where I live in Atlanta. Is this idea that you need to control people's access to fields and control, and I know this is true in LA from having been out there, that you know, controlling what people can do in a particular space in a particular time. You know, when street football was played in England, the 1800s and then earlier than that, the way it was controlled was through the Highways Act. I mean, they banned or tried to control the sport through that because it was impeding commerce.
Wait, what do you mean?
So idea that soccer intrudes on space or on the practice of the free market or the practice of commerce is one that disturbs. And I get so angry, almost to the point of tears, playing here in Atlanta sometimes on Saturdays when we just want to play a game with friends, a pickup game, and somebody will run out and say we're using their park and you know, we don't have any permission to be there on the space. And I just think, what crime are we committing?
Yeah. What, can we go back to this Highways Act that you just mentioned?
Right.
What was that? Yeah, I'm sorry. This is a part of soccer history that I don't know.
Yeah, in the 1800s, and it's not just in England, but this is true, I think, in South Africa as well, that street football was very disturbing to authorities.
Oh.
It was impeding, they argued, the flow of traffic, and the reality was is that it just created this area of unregulated play.
Right.
And the way to control street soccer in England was to do it through the Highways Act. There was an act passed in relation to the flow of commerce in which street football was prohibited. And this is one of the early ways of getting, you know, getting soccer players in line. And that's a theme in history. You know, you think of the World Cup and you think of all the glory and attached to being an elite footballer and all that means. But being a footballer, being a football supporter in much of history and much of the world is not something to be aspired to. It's something that people frequently are ashamed of. In places like Brazil, I haven't checked the roster for this World Cup, but in the last one, if you go through the list of Brazilian players, you find only one who has what could be called a middle-class background, and that's Kaká. All the other players come from very poor backgrounds, and that's not because there aren't really good players in the middle class. It's just because it's seen as very risky. It's an incredibly risky thing to do with your life. I've met any number of players who used to play in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Very, very good, elite-level players selected very early on in their careers for academies and top teams who left when they could. I mean, who left, to move to Canada or the States or whatever. The lure of a soccer career isn't that, it's not that esteemable. It's not something really to be sought after. The same is true for women players. There's a lot more things discouraging women from playing than actually pursuing a life in it.
When we're talking about the players that we're going to see in a World Cup, right, we forget that the majority of people who play soccer for a living are barely making a living.
Right.
I mean, that in the lower divisions and in countries where you have a professional league, which is barely really a professional league. I point to India in the I-League, for example. I mean, none of those players are making a fortune or are making enough money to bank towards the future when they won't be able to play anymore and they won't have done anything else, right, over the duration of their adult years. And that's actually the kind of the day-to-day reality of the sport is much less glamorous and much – it's very sort of a tenuous connection to economic stability, even within the MLS, right? So when it really is it's not – again, as you said, it's not a reasonable thing to decide to do with yourself. It's a it's a great risk, and economic stability is by no means something you can even hope for, really. The average player.
No, it's a crazy life, and it's I love writing about football because I'm crazy about it, and I feel like I always connect with other people's insanity, particularly players in these kinds of situations or women players. They're making difficult choices. They're trying to live honestly. They're trying to fulfill their aspirations and their truly felt desires inside and living in this way, even though it is going against the grain.
The story of Yudi Simulane and her life, right, actually resonates very strongly with that of the very committed player, right? She got to a point which, many women in Africa would long for to represent her country in international competition, and then came home and built a life around footballing. And participating in a footballing community, and that's actually much closer to the story of top players within a local community, right? Who are not sucked up into the ether, right, of European men's football, at the highest levels. And the passion and the commitment of a player like her. A player like the U.S. women playing in the late 80s and the 90s before anyone cared. it was their care and their commitment that drove them to do it. It was like a calling, and I love that about players. And and I think it's important that we as writers find ways to honor that. I think the structure of mainstream sports journalism really does make it hard to kind of tell those stories of people whose careers perhaps don't have a happy ending by traditional standards, but whose lives are about the practice of happiness. I think those are important stories to put out there for us to have access to.
The statistical likelihood of making a lot of money off of soccer for a player, I mean, it simply is the most practiced skill set and craft in the world.
Yeah.
We're probably 2 million, 3 million, I mean, billion. People have played soccer in their lives, and more than any other sort of shared human cultural practice. And what are there, maybe 2,000 people who are wealthy off of playing?
And believe me, those they're basically just a tiny. You can count them on one hand. The women who've actually made money, like wealth, right? If that's even the right word for it. Somebody like Mia Hamm, perhaps. Marta's definitely making a lot of money relative to other players, but she's not making money compared to a man of her ability. When I saw her pull her very sort of famous, amazing moves in last Women's World Cup when Brazil defeated soundly, just humiliated the American women. I was watching that in France, and it was like a cri de guerre on the television station. It was a woman announcer, actually, and she was just, you know, screaming, you know, if she were a man, she would be making millions. C'est pas juste. C'est pas juste. It's not right. It's not right. You know, just saying that over and over again. And everyone in the bar I was in jumped up to their feet, and they were shouting, Maradona, Maradona. And they were tearing up and, like, weeping, you know. And it was, but part of the pain of that moment was also this, and the glory of it, I think, and the romance of it was this sense of this kind of moment of this extraordinary gesture, this extraordinary ability and the beauty of it is happening in a context in which there is nothing like what happens around the World Cup in terms of the people making bank off of it. You know, I mean, there's just I don't know who makes money off of women's soccer these days. And I should gesture towards the latest headlines in the WPS, which the folding of the second team this season as the people financing women's soccer are backing away from their own commitment to the league. They had committed to, you know, knowing they were going to lose money for several years and, you know, times get tough and they're gone. So that's two teams collapsing. So I digress. Women's soccer is often pulls me away from the World Cup, as it would. So.
Well, but again, even with what you're talking about, with what you watched in France and people's joy, I mean, that is of course at the root of why we do love the games of the World Cup, which is that we have all practiced this craft, or so many of us have, and to see the people who are the greatest, most beautiful practitioners of it. That's the sort of unalienated draw of a World Cup.
Yeah.
And we're speaking with John Turnbull, editor of The Global Game. And actually, John, before we let you go, you know, again, the sort of fan-friendly aspect of the interviews on the People's Game, the, you know, the World Cup 2010. What are your thoughts going into the tournament in terms of teams you like, players you like, or just sort of the whole spectacle itself?
Or people
itself
to root for.
Yeah. Right. Well, I don't know. Are Arsenal playing?
Well, here, right
that,
here.
France is. That's, so that would be ideal.
Carlos.
If Arsenal were entered, then I would really have a reason to watch.
Carlos Vela is going to, he could become a very, very important person in this region of the world that we live in here.
I hope so. Generally speaking, I do root for the national side that has the most Arsenal players.
spread all roster, over, actually. That's
a
pretty international team.
France.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about this time. I like I quite like Spain.
Yeah.
Because of Fabregas.
Mm. Right. But he starts on the bench, except Iniesta's hurt now.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, that's what I look forward to. And Carlos Vela, as you say, with Mexico. You know, it's odd. That's the way I look at it. I don't have this any feeling of nationalism. If I did, it would be for Scotland, if Scotland ever could qualify.
Yeah. Right.
I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, but that's the place that I feel.
Yeah, you know, Lynn Truss, the author, has a book called Get Her Off the Pitch about her years working as a sports journalist. And there she makes this, in the last chapter especially, which talks about her shift when she gives up sports writing, and she sort of did it for a very limited time in her writing career. She makes this observation about how, you know, for those who were not following something, you know, like soccer in particular in the English Premiership or, you know, international competitions, it's the same thing over and over and over again. She's like, what difference does it really make who wins the World Cup? It seems to make all the difference in the world, and yet it's the same thing over and over and over again. Ultimately, it's the same story. It's the same product. And she was, you know, it's this amazing kind of moment where she it's as if she had drunk the Kool-Aid, but then sort of came out of some kind of a trance. You know, the book describes this the passion and this kind of the monomania, right, of writing about soccer and also being a reporter, reporting on matches in particular, and then having something happen in her life which has her step back from that. And then she was amazed at how, when she walked away from it, how little she cared. And as a writer, I love that, because I think that there's something about the grind of match reporting and speculation on who's going to win and who's going to lose. And, you know, and I think a lot of people who actually love the sport actually find that kind of conversation sort of like, there's no point of entry for me into that. I just want to root for Fabregas.
Yeah. And, well, the life of, and it's a male-oriented life, for the most part, of the sports writers' world and the football writers' world. And the thing that always disturbs me is the facade of all-knowing that's maintained consistently.
Yeah.
From in a situation in which, having written about sport for newspapers, I know nothing. I know nothing about competing at that level. I don't know any questions to ask. And the best writing,
right,
the best revelations about the sport are from people who admit that,
yeah,
right off the top. And
I
like that the type of writing that I'm able to do, I couldn't do for a publication that had some sort of an economic reason for being, because that facade of all-knowing is what keeps things moving. You know, you keep the machinery running.
Yeah, I said that.
Yeah, the post-game reports are really sort of cynical exercises in just trying to capture the thrill people had while they were watching the match.
Yeah, it's the illusion of mastery suppressing the expression of wonder.
Right. Yeah. You know,
Dan, I thought I did well with that. You did better, though.
That's the illusion of mastery masquerading as a sense of wonder.
Well. Fortunately, the moment passes. But, you know, there's so much. There is. Look, Italy won last time, and I've been an Italian partisan. And in just watching, you know, Circo Massimo, you know, it's I don't know what else to say about that except, wow, there's something going on here. You know, there's a lot of dimension to it. Italian nationalism. You know, why so many people care so much in Italy about this result, and it's you know, like half the country probably viewed it as the highlight of their year, and you know, it's certainly a phenomenon. Mm. I'm not quite sure what else to say about it except it's a phenomenon. Mm. You know.
Well, and you know, used a piece for Mario Vargas Llosa in our anthology. Yeah. He was writing for El País, I think, during the 1982 World Cup, and he was having some of these, you know, conflicts that we're having, you know, these internal voices that we're not quite sure to do with, and at the end of the piece, he just says, well, you know, let's just enjoy it for a little bit. Let's just forget it.
I want to say about the anthology that John Turnbull edited, The Global Game, Writers on Soccer, that's a mix of pointed pieces of journalism, of poetry, fiction, essays, occasional essays, and it's a real variety of genres and voices from all over the world, a very unique anthology and an important one, which documents both the kind of breadth of approaches to soccer and also the diversity of footballing cultures. And I want to compliment you on the work that went into that. There's a lot of translation work in particular that's represented there. And it's a lovely anthology, and I think it's also a perfect expression of your generosity as a writer and as an editor of the on your website, The Global Game.
Well, thanks very much. It's a really nice comment, and I want to say thanks to Tom Satterley, who was the co-editor, and he's a poet and a literary translator from Danish, and he made it possible because it wouldn't have an English, a predominantly English language, English language of origin anthology would not have been representative.
No.
And I was pleased that that the vast majority did not come from English. And that's one thing about the World Cup is, you know, I tend to look at it from the English language perspective, and, you know, I might venture out by going to the BBC or, you know, heaven forbid, to the South African press. But there's so many other ways of talking about football that we don't even know about. This kind of anthropological turn that writing about the sport has taken in English over the last 15 or 20 years was done a long time ago in Latin America and Africa and who knows where else.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Thank you so much for this interview. We've covered a really wide range of topics, and I'm so glad we got to talk about the art of writing and thinking about soccer. And again, I really appreciate your thoughtfulness and your generosity in taking this time to talk with us.
Well, thanks, Jennifer. Thanks, Alan. I enjoyed it.
And you can follow John Turnbull's writing about the global game at www.theglobalgame.com. Thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game.
All right. Cheers.